Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 3rd, 2012. When it comes to haggling for a pay raise, women have been told that these are reasons they're not getting what they want.
It's because they don't value pay. It's because they're not willing to confront their manager. It's because they're not willing to negotiate or negotiate as effectively.
Well, ladies, new research shows it's not all your fault, and we'll hear about that. And whatever happened to that whole good things come to those who wait idea?
The crush of technology is ruining our decision-making. The relentlessness of email and social media and the 24-hour news cycle is speeding up our decisions and forcing us to get things done now.
Turns out procrastination is good for you. Yay! And the first in a series of conversations about religion and money. This week, Islam.
Money cannot be stored in banks or under the mattress or in the pillow. It got to be invested back in the community.
It's all next on Marketplace Money from APM.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Sometimes we come across stories that I just fall in love with, and today we're going to start with one of them. Now, we can tell you over and over how to dig yourself out of debt, or we could just let you listen to an example of how one woman took control and dug herself out with a mop and no small amount of humility. Chrissy Clark has the story from our Wealth and Poverty Desk.
When Celie Niehaus was growing up, her dad had a saying about spending and credit cards.
Don't charge anything that you put in your mouth.
Translation.
Don't charge dinners, don't charge drinks or anything like that. You know, if you're going to actually carry some debt for something that you purchase, at least have something to show for it.
But like a lot of Americans, one day Celie woke up with a spending hangover. She was in her late 20s at the time and in deep, deep credit card debt. $10,000, or half her annual income. She could barely afford the minimum payments, and they felt like a losing battle anyway. All this money trouble was especially stinging for her since she was, well, she was an officer at a bank.
Had been in financial services for many years and knew better and still made the same mistake that many consumers make. Too much consumption, had a little too much fun, got myself in debt, and of course at the end of the day you have to pay it back.
Celie had actually started her banking career working for a credit card debt collection company, so she was well versed in the mechanics of paying off debt. Reduce spending, increase revenue. First, she worked on the reduced spending part. Went on a shopping freeze, stopped going out to eat.
I started walking to and from work.
The raising revenue part, that was a little trickier. Her job at the bank was full-time and salaried.
So I couldn't work extra hours at the bank to increase my income, which led me to the second job. I was fortunate enough to know some people that worked for the Fayette County school system, and they had told me about a janitor's job.
And she took it. She lived a little like Superman, down to the costume change. Banker by day.
I did wear my tennis shoes to and from work in my business suit.
Janitor by night.
Jeans and t-shirts.
She worked 5 nights a week, 4 hours a night as a janitor, and it gave her a different perspective on her day job.
Being able to sit behind a desk, it's fairly easy, but the janitorial staff, the things that they get stuck doing. I learned a lot about cleaning, believe me.
50 offices every day.
Empty the trash can, vacuum on my hands and knees to clean the table. The glass would need to be fingerprint free. The mopping, that's not an easy job. That mop is heavy.
Then one day, she was rushing back from her banker job in her business suit.
Trying to get home, change my clothes.
And on her way, she ran into a woman who worked in the school administration offices she cleaned.
She made eye contact with me.
Celie waved at her, said hello.
She looked at me. There was no recognition. And I said, it's Celie.
Then Celie said, oh, right.
You don't recognize without my garbage can. That's when she realized that I was the janitor.
The woman asked why she was dressed so nice, and Celie explained the whole situation. By the time she got in for her janitorial shift that evening, everyone who worked in the office seemed to know about her secret life as a banker. And from that day forward,
as I went from office space with my garbage can and vacuum, they would start asking me financial services questions, questions about loans, questions about debt. When I left, they gave me a going-away party, and someone had said, they've never given a janitor a going-away party.
It took Celie 2 years at the janitorial job to make enough money to pay off her credit card. As an added bonus, she actually created some savings, too. the retirement plan and health insurance as a janitor were back then actually better than at her banking job, so she dropped the benefits at the bank. And today, nearly 20 years later, she's never had to go back to janitorial work. Turns out the banking things worked out pretty well. She's now a vice president at E-Trade, the chief compliance officer.
Going from a janitor to chief compliance officer of the bank does sound like an enormous leap, although I feel like I clean up all the time.
These days, Celie says she keeps a tight grip on her debt. She has a car loan and a mortgage, but tries to pay off her credit card every month. In her spare time, she now teaches young people about personal finance. She uses her story as a lesson.
To help them understand that everybody can get into a situation, but you may have to make some sacrifices and do some things you don't particularly care for to get yourself out of that situation.
She says people shouldn't shrink from taking a ground-level job to get out of money trouble. She hopes maybe those office workers she met as a janitor learned that lesson too. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Brace yourselves, my fellow double X chromosome holders. This week we have yet another piece of evidence that, yes, men still make more than women and they get bigger raises. Can you see the steam coming out of my ears? Well, this is all confirmed by a study that was designed to find out if and why men are more successful in negotiating raises from their managers. The study's author joins us, Professor Maura Beliveau of Long Island University in New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Tess.
I have to tell you that this was just kind of the latest in a long line of studies that are just entirely depressing for any of us who are women in the workplace.
I'm afraid I can't disagree.
Yeah. Well, it is settled knowledge that the gender gap is alive and well when it comes to wages. But what we have here, it sounds like, is perhaps an unintentional move by managers who are giving lower raises to women because women are more willing to believe that they can't have a bigger one because of the economy or what's happening with the company.
That is one interpretation of the results. I think the interpretation I make is a little more generous to managers, which is that it's not that they actually think women are more likely to be reasonable in general. It's more that they think women value symbolic treatment and symbolic rewards. In some way, giving an explanation to someone suggests that that person has status. And so if you are debating about what level of pay to give someone and you have in mind that you are going to be able to give that person some other symbolic reward, some symbolic good, in this case, you're going to confer on them the status associated with treating them with respect and giving them an explanation. So the excuse itself is something managers think about as, I get to do something nice for her.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're looking at men and deliberating about a pay raise for men, it's not that they think that men don't value status or respectful treatment, but they in no sense think of that as substitutable for a better outcome.
Then whose fault is this? I mean, that sounds to me like maybe we women have allowed the message to get out there that we value some sort of explanation of why we're not getting a raise more than the raise.
Well, I find it interesting that there's a lot of evidence that women value pay as much as men. If you look within an occupation.
I'd vote for that.
If you were to look within the medical profession, and for instance, there was just a big study on women in academic medicine and men and pay,
mm-hmm.
That showed even if you control for specialty and hours worked and various other things, as you said, the gender gap is alive and well. And so then the question becomes, if women are reporting on surveys that they value pay when they're in a high paying occupation, but they're still not getting it,
mm-hmm.
I think it's more that the word is not out, even though the evidence is there. there are people that do research on something called system-justifying beliefs. And if you are looking for a reason for the gender wage gap and you don't want to say that the problem is how managers think about men and women, you want an easier solution.
An outright discrimination.
Right. Then you in a sense, can blame women. You can basically say it's because they don't value pay. It's because they're not willing to confront their manager. It's because they're not willing to negotiate or negotiate as effectively. And I think that overlooks the fundamental first move in any salary negotiation, which is the first offer. And the first offer comes from what your manager offers you. So let's say managers do subscribe to these beliefs. Then what they can do is make those initial offers to women their lowball offers.
Right.
And what women are then challenged to do is negotiate from a disadvantaged position. And anyone who takes negotiation courses or training knows that it's extremely challenging to negotiate a true lowball offer.
All right. Well, then I suppose the message for managers out there would be that's BS and women are definitely interested in getting more money, no matter what the explanation is for why you can't. But I mean, based on your experiment here where, you know, men got 71% of the money that was available in this raise pool. What am I supposed to do about that as the female employee?
Well, I think one thing we can advocate for is more transparency about pay. Mm. I think what we need is women to advocate for pay to be audited in their organizations. Mm. So for HR, before any raises are announced, to advocate that HR in your company review all the raises and do a gender analysis. Advocate for HR to look at the unintended systemic biases that might crop up, especially when resources are constrained.
All right, ladies out there, you all have your marching orders. Maura Beliveau is an associate professor in the College of Management at LIU Post in Brookville, New York. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
It's August already. Summer is over, folks. Okay, not quite, but it feels like it. If you've been able to take a vacation, I hope it was a real one, devoid of emails and texts, maybe even Facebook. Commentator Jen Miller has learned her lesson.
When I became self-employed in 2005, I considered my job a 24/7 operation. I worked from 7 to 7 and answered emails until much later. Weekends off? For slackers. I didn't put up the out-of-office message because I was never out of the office. I know this isn't just me. Last year, Americans left 226 million unused vacation days on the table. Is this good for us? Would my business be hobbled if I put up an out-of-office message and stuck to it? Last summer, my boyfriend dragged me to his family's annual retreat at a place called Woodchuck, a collection of cabins on a small lake in New York State. There's no electricity and no cell phone reception. No way to check email. I put up the out-of-office message and waited for anxiety to strike. Guess what happened? Nothing. Nothing except eating pancakes and bacon cooked over a wood fire stove for breakfast every morning. Nothing except running the hills of the Adirondacks, then jumping into the lake in my workout clothes. No one showered. Everyone napped. I learned how to kayak, but chickened out on the rope swing. I read 4 books in 5 days. My smartphone, useless, stayed at the bottom of my duffel bag. We need time away from work, even if it's work that we love. Sure, I enjoy writing. But I also need time when the most pressing issue is whether to read the romance novel or the mystery next. Decisions about blueberries versus bananas in the pancakes is a big one, too. It recharges me. It makes my writing better, much more lively than when I'm producing copy while chained to my desk. I'm headed back to Woodchuck in a few weeks, this time without the, oh my God, no email anxiety. I can't wait.
Jen Miller is the author of Book a Week with Jen, 1 year, 52 books, and the year of starting a new chapter.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
And it is time for your letters now. And here's the man with the mailbag, our senior producer, Patty Hirsch.
Hello.
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 Did you miss me last week?
I did miss you. Of course we did. You're back.
Aw, that's so nice. So what happened last week? What did I miss?
Well, you know, we had this other guy hosting the show.
Oh, yeah. The guy, Hobson.
Yeah. So we thought we'd clear things out, bring you back, and also bring back David Lazarus.
Excellent. Hey, David.
Hello. Well, let me give you a pat. Hello.
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 So let me tell you, the first thing that's on our listeners' minds that we got a lot of mail about is you'll be surprised to know, math.
The man.
They're into math. Well, it appears that the attorney that Jeremy spoke to last week is also not the woman for math.
Yep.
So he was speaking to this attorney who said that a lawyer earning $160,000 was essentially working for minimum wage. Right. So a lot of people ran the numbers on that very quickly and found that even working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, 52 weeks a year, that would still be well above minimum wage. But in fairness to Jeremy, he did actually question the attorney. He was like, oh, come on, he said. Those were his precise words. But of course, he didn't have a calculator handy, so he couldn't run the numbers himself. But fortunately, we had lots of listeners who did.
We had lots of listeners who did. Yeah. Went straight to a calculator.
Which
and
is great.
Sent us the math.
I think that's great. And what's interesting about it is it shows how skewed people's perception of their own workloads can be, right? I mean, these people really think they work that
minimum
hard
wage.
For minimum wage, and it's just not true. So I thought that was actually really revealing.
My guess is that the rest of the mailbag was probably taken up by comments about John Stossel.
Comments about John Stossel,
indeed,
yes. You know who John Stossel is.
Of course,
David,
I do.
Right? Yeah. He works on Fox News. He recently broadcast a show that purported to show that Americans weren't willing to do hard jobs.
Yes. And
goodness.
And I think people were a bit upset about this.
Well, some people were very upset, but a lot of people were actually very supportive. You know, they had a lot of defenders writing in to say that it is true that Americans often turn up their noses at minimum wage jobs. But of course, on the other side, people said, well, those minimum wage jobs can barely sustain a person, you know, breathing, let alone living.
I can think of a few of my friends in the SEIU union that clean people's toilets and their offices and all the rest who would say, you know what? Bad on you, John Stossel.
Right. No, absolutely. And now, a lot of people claimed that Stossel had no data substantiating his thesis, and he was quoting the Help Wanted Index, saying that it's at an all-time high. So we checked that, and I think he's talking about the Conference Board's Help Wanted Index. And indeed, it is showing the highest demand for jobs since May 2005. But most of those jobs are in professional categories, business, finance, healthcare professionals, and management, which, of course, you need seriously
qualified for.
And you're probably racking up student loan debt of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to get it.
Exactly.
And by the way, with regard to the Stossel interview, you know, it sparked a great conversation online. And that's one of the reasons that we wanted to do this. We wanted to hear what people thought about this kind of thing. We wanted to generate conversation. There's a very interesting conversation going on online on the website. So I would encourage listeners to get on there and comment and sort of pitch in and let us know what you think. And now a number of other letters that we got in, I'm hoping that David can help us with. Suzanne B. wrote in from Long Beach. She's currently working with some recruiters to find a new job. The recruiters have been asking her to give her consent to be checked for everything from drug use to her financial situation at home. So she's applying for white-collar positions with web companies, and she's wondering if it is actually legal to check a candidate's credit and financial background before offering them a job.
And the answer is yes, as long as they get your permission up front. And then the next question is going to be, how often does that happen? And the answer to that is it's become fairly routine, especially with the white-collar, high-paying jobs, those that might have a lot of benefits and things. You're basically going to be family. Mm-hmm. They want to know who you are, and they want to know it in microscopic detail. And there are a lot of companies, data brokers, that are out there who live to serve when a company does a background check on you. But it's become fairly routine at this point.
And you should also be aware that your potential employer actually doesn't even have to hire these companies anymore to find out a whole lot about you online. Google yourself. Find out what's up there. Find out what pops up first, what kind of photos are up there. And that's the kind of thing that you should clean up before you even start applying for
that. That's a mini background check. And I think what a lot of people should be aware of is Facebook lives forever.
Indeed.
Right. Twitter lives forever.
Yep.
And those glib or amusing vacation posts that you were doing with bikinis and beers and tequila shots.
One?
I did, and I thought, on you. Well done. You know, if only John Stossel was there and the two of you could have partied away. But this stuff is there in perpetuity. And anybody, especially somebody who is applying for a job, go online and clean up your profile as best you can first.
Okay.
On that note.
Yeah. The sunshine right there, huh?
So this next one is something that you've brought up a number of times with me, Tess. Those letters or emails that we get from time to time inviting us to participate in a class action lawsuit.
Right, I get those.
Right. Often against a huge corporation.
Actually, I think I got one recently that had something to do with Groupon.
Right. So what are these things? Are they like phishing expeditions, you know, or are they real? Could you get rich by responding to them?
Yes and yes. They are phishing expeditions and they are typically real. But no, you're probably
you
not going to get rich.
Yeah.
And what's happening here is there are lists of shareholders of companies and class action attorneys when they file a suit against a big company, whether it's Groupon, whether it's Google, whether it's Microsoft, whoever it may be, they're going to bombard anybody who might be able to be eligible for the class with an invitation to join. Mm. Now, as we all know from past stories about this kind of thing, the lawyers clean up in a class action.
Right.
They might get a third to 40% of the take, which could run into millions and millions of dollars.
You might get like $3.
$3 or a coupon for $3
right.
to use at the offending website.
Or a Groupon.
Exactly. and that's kind of the ugly little underside of this sort of thing. But does that mean that you want to get rid of class actions and do total tort reform? And the answer to that is no, because class actions are one of the most effective tools that consumers have to hold companies accountable. Will you get rich? No. Will you be able to hold a company's feet to the fire with a major settlement? Yes. And that's the key aspect here, that even though this isn't going to be a way for everybody to basically cut themselves in for a huge piece of the action, the lawyers are going to clean up. In reality, though, without class actions, there are a lot of minor trespasses by the business world that you simply could not go after them for. And with a class action, there is more accountability. Now, for anyone who's wondering, is it good for me? I'll tell you right now, when I get these, I seldom sign up simply because I just don't see it as being worth my time for what I'm being asked to give. And let's face it, a coupon for 10 cents, I can live without it right now. But on the other hand, if company XYZ has done something, a privacy violation, a whatever, I do want to see their feet held to the fire, and that's why I think class actions do have a lot of merit.
All right. Thanks, David.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Patty.
Thank you.
It's a good thing I'm in a deadline business because I love nothing more than to wait until the very last minute to get stuff done. Now, most of my life I've heard that that's a problem, that procrastination is not, as Martha Stewart might put it, a good thing. But Frank Partnoy has come to the rescue of people like me with a new book called Wait. Turns out procrastinators just might be onto something after all. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
I have to start by asking you about the cover art on your book. This is an adorable golden retriever with a dog biscuit perched right on his snout. Now, this is a great trick, but we humans can't be so trained, can we?
We can, and we need to be. And that, in fact, the dog can smell this treat and is showing us a very important lesson in life and in business, which is people are better off and happier. They make better decisions when they're able to delay gratification.
But that just doesn't fit with the way we think of things these days. I mean, everything is about speed right now, isn't it?
It is. And the crush of technology is ruining our decision making. The relentlessness of email and social media and the 24-hour news cycle is speeding up our decisions. And the industry that's been built up around making us feel guilty about procrastination, this anti-procrastination industry, has been making us feel bad, forcing us to get things done now. And the crush of technology has really made it impossible to get everything done now. So one of the things I wanted to do was to show people that although we've heard from psychologists and behavioral economists and neuroscientists about how we make decisions, about why we make decisions, about what kinds of decisions are the right decisions, we haven't heard or focused enough on when. Mm. And I wanted to spend an entire book trying to show people how they can be better off focusing on when and often acting a lot later than they are now.
I did want to talk briefly, even though we're not a science show, about this nerve that is central to both our gut instinct and how we actually do contemplate. It's this singular strand around our brains, right? And does that mean that our ability to wait or not is all biological?
It's not all biological, but like a lot of problems, it's part nature and part nurture. The vagal nerve is a nerve that is at the base of the brain. It starts and it winds through our bodies and it connects the brain to the heart. And one of the things that I found most surprising in the 3 years of research I did for this book was that this vagal nerve and the heart rate variability that we all have is hugely important to our decision making. Basically, what heart rate variability is how fast our hearts will speed up or slow down. It's kind of like a high-performance car would be able to brake very quickly or accelerate very quickly. And if we can do that with our hearts, if we can stimulate them quickly, slow them down quickly, even as children, we're going to end up being much better off as adults.
Huh. Fascinating. Well, one of the times that our heart rate tends to respond quite quickly is when we are panicked. And you spend an entire chapter in the book talking about that and what it does to our ability to wait for things. Now, it seems obvious that if we're panicking, we're probably going to act on instinct. And I think for our purposes, I'd like to talk about that in terms of investing and this constant mistake that we make of selling when markets are on the way down. That, by definition, of course, is panic, isn't it? And it seems to be something that people simply cannot control.
It's very difficult to control. We're captivated by fear, and we're hardwired with this fight or flight response.
Right.
So that when we see something dangerous happening in the markets, we want to run away. But one of the messages of the studies of investing behavior is that we're better off delaying. And if we look at the kinds of investors we'd want to emulate, they aren't acting like day traders all the time. They're very patient. They're willing to pause. And it was very interesting to me in researching this book that so many of the high-frequency trading algorithms are starting to behave a lot like we should behave, which is that they're building in pauses. So I think it's one of the biggest challenges that investors face, and I wanted to give people some comfort and some understanding that it's not their fault. It's not that there's something wrong with them. It's really about how human beings are hardwired, and all animals are hardwired, and yet part of the human condition, one of the unique things we can do as human beings is think about the future for a while. The dog on the cover of the book can hold that bone there for maybe a few minutes.
Right.
The dog on the cover of the book can't save for retirement. And what makes us unique as human beings is to be able to think long-term into the future. Actually, there was a study this year, a dog did pretty well. Some researchers showed that a female sheepdog didn't make it to retirement,
no.
But the record for the dog was the dog held a chicken chew treat in its mouth for 10 full minutes while
Whoa.
Waiting for the prospect of a chicken chew treat 8 times bigger. That's basically as good as a dog can do. But humans can do better, and this is what distinguishes us as human beings. And one of the things I hope is that people who are inundated with so much of this crush of technology and high-speed reactions will take a step back and say, you know what, as a human being, the thing that I can do is to think about a longer time horizon, to plan for a year or 2 years or 10 years.
Frank Partnoy is the author of Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you've waited and waited to book a summer vacation, you're probably going to have to spend more money on it. AAA says the average American spends $1,000 on his or her summer vacation. I'm sure there is a multiple of that if you book everything last minute. So plenty of folks will be scrambling to find travel on the cheap. But before you do, let's hear from Meg Favreau, senior editor at wisebread.com and our frugality expert. Meg, good to see you.
Good to see you, Tess.
I think we hear all the time about all these cheap ways to go on vacation, and there have to be some downsides to that, or perhaps some ways not to do it that would not result in you immediately regretting having gone on vacation. You know, Craigslist, great for picking up a desk, but I hear it's not so great for finding a hotel.
Actually, the thing that Craigslist is really awful for is getting a vacation rental. Because there is a vacation rental scam out there. I was actually at a wedding in Key West where this happened to some other people at the wedding. They got a vacation rental off of Craigslist. They paid for it up front. Beautiful looking house. Mm-hmm. They go up. They knock on the door. The guy opens the door. They're like, hey, we're here for our vacation rental. The guy's like, I have no idea. This is just my house.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so people will go up and just put other people's houses up, take the money, and run with it.
Really?
Yeah. And it's one of those things that unless it happened to somebody I know, I'd be like, oh, yeah, like that happens. But it does. But the good news is that there are other ways to get vacation rentals from a person that are not through Craigslist, using sites like Airbnb and VRBO.
VRBO, yeah.
Yeah.
Vacation rental by owner.
Yes.
All right. Well, what are some of the other traps that travelers should be aware of as they are trying to plan on the cheap?
I would say be wary of off-season travel. I love off-season travel. I think it's great, but you need to do your research to know exactly what you're going to get when you go.
So do not travel to the Caribbean perhaps in August.
Or if you do, just know exactly what's open and what you'll be able to do. I mean, my...
And what kind of hurricane might come your way.
Yeah. But like my big example is I went to Belize during the off-season and it was amazing except for the fact that we showed up, we got to our hotel, we got checked in. We took a nap. We wake up. It's night. Mm-hmm. Nobody else is there. There is no staff.
What?
We do not see any lights on in anyone else's hotel rooms.
Why? They just left?
Yeah.
Hello.
Nobody stays there at night.
And that was because it was the off season?
Because it was the off season. They were just starting back up again. Like, their restaurant wasn't open. We found out it wasn't going to open for 2 more weeks. The upside of it is we got a free upgrade to a room with a kitchen because they realized they kind of had to give us a way to feed ourselves.
Yeah. All right. Any other do not do's?
So another thing to be aware of is out of the way hotels.
Mm.
Another mistake that I made. Going to Minneapolis, got a out-of-the-way hotel because I had a friend tell me that the public transit was pretty good there.
Mm.
Does not go to this hotel.
It was way out of the way.
It was like kind of like this frugal Bermuda Triangle because it was like, oh, we got the cheap deal with the out-of-the-way hotel and we can, you know, use the
public transport.
The public transport. But nope, these things do not work together.
Right.
I think that a mistake I know I've made in the past and I think some frugal travelers make is considering only money and not time.
Yes. Especially if you're going somewhere you've never been.
Exactly. And the other thing, too, is I have certainly been guilty of this, buying the plane ticket that's $30 cheaper that has 2 stopovers.
Right.
So you spend a full day traveling when, you know, if you spend an extra $30, you know, you'd get there by lunchtime, have
right.
the whole afternoon to explore. You really need to decide what your time is worth to you on vacation.
Right. And that's going to be different, I think, for everybody.
Exactly.
So I guess the real lesson here is that cheap does not always equal the best vacation you're ever going to have.
Right.
Sometimes you're going to have to maybe just budget more closely, spend a little more money, and then the time that you're taking away from work and from all of the other things that you do in life, it's going to be more valuable for you.
Exactly. And I don't mean to say that like a super frugal vacation can't be wonderful.
It can be indeed.
It can be. But it's just a matter of being like, don't compromise with yourself too much. If there's a vacation you really want to take, if you want to go to London and see the museums, don't go to London and not see the museums.
I like that policy a lot, actually. Meg Favreau, senior editor of Wisebread.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Tess.
Is money the root of all evil? Should you always have to pay interest when you borrow? Should we be required to tithe? Every religion treats money differently. And over the next few weeks, we're going to take a look at the role that the church, the mosque, or the temple plays in our financial decisions. This week, to mark the month of Ramadan, we take a look at Islamic finance, and in particular, its view on interest, or riba. Dr. Yahya Abdul-Rahman is the author of The Art of Islamic Banking and Finance. He also runs a mortgage firm in Pasadena, California, called American Finance House La Riba, which means riba free. Welcome to the show.
Okay.
Tell us, first of all, as a general rule, how, if at all, does the Islamic religion differ in its view of money than other faiths?
So money is a measuring device. And it measures the success or failure of an investment. So money has to be invested back in the community to generate economic prosperity, job opportunity with prudence. And the reason I say it's a measuring device is that you cannot rent it. And that's the whole idea behind the teachings in Judaism and Christianity and Islam of you cannot rent money at an interest rate hoping that you'll make that interest rate. You have to prudently invest it.
So this is the idea that interest is actually not a good thing, that you cannot charge money for money.
You cannot rent money for money, but you can invest money and participate in the reward or the risk of loss of the venture.
Hmm.
The second thing, which is very important, is money does not make people, create people, or make them respectable. Money actually is a tool, and people earn money by working hard and providing services.
But isn't that the case no matter your faith?
No matter your faith. This is how we believe about money. The third thing about money is money cannot be stored in banks or under the mattress or in the pillow. It got to be invested back in the community to generate job opportunities, economic prosperity, and a wonderful life in the community amongst all people of all faith. And last but not the least, that whatever profits you make, you have to pay the share of God in that profit, which is called in a Christian culture tithe.
Right.
We call it zakat, which is a purification process of your income by paying back the right of God in your assets.
And for Christians, they would generally think that that was, you know, I think about 10% of
yes.
what you have.
It depends on the church, on the
sure.
thought. In our
sure.
case, it is a little bit more sophisticated. It has to do with the kind of asset you have.
Hmm.
So if it is cash in the bank, you pay 2.5% on it.
2.5%?
2.5%
okay.
every year. And the amazing thing is there is a level below which you don't pay anything, which is 3 ounces of gold.
So it's the price of gold at what point during the year?
In the midpoint.
The
usually,
midpoint?
Yeah.
Huh.
People pay their zakat in the month of Ramadan, usually.
Okay. Because as we know, the price of gold has fluctuated quite
exactly.
wildly recently.
So if it is cash, you pay more on the cash. Why? Because the system entices you to invest it back in the community. Why? Because it produces job opportunities, economic prosperity, and so on and so forth.
Got it.
We call it in the Americanized Islamic literature, zakatable income. It's like taxable income.
So the more money you have, the more you're probably going to pay
yeah.
in tithing.
Yes. But then it is designed as to what kind of investment you invest in. If you invest in arid land to reclaim the desert, for instance, then the zakah is 2.5% of your net crop. If it is in land which is irrigated by waterways, it's 5%. If it is irrigated by rain, it is 10%. The zakah on the minerals, for instance, these minerals are a gift of God. It's 20% of what you produce. So I think if you talk to the people in the many oil-producing and gold-producing and diamond-producing countries, they should cut away 20% of that income and give it to those who need it.
Wow.
These are the poor, the needy, the destitute, people who are in heavy debt, not because of their choice, but because of the situation. We have many of them here in America today.
So there is one amount of tithing on cash. There are other amounts on property, on
yes.
land.
Yes.
Are there other factors
yes,
as well?
Yes, there is. First of all, you cannot store gold. You cannot take gold as per se as an investment. It is not allowed. You cannot take silver and store it for investment and hoard it away. But you can invest in apartment complexes. And investment in an apartment complex, you only pay on the cash that you collect from the rents minus the expenses, 10%.
Okay.
And you don't pay anything else. In other words, you can be investing $2 million in an apartment complex. You don't pay on the $2 million, but you pay on the income from that investment.
Does money mean something different to a family of the Islamic faith?
Well, I share with you what my dad used to tell me. My dad used to say, money respects those who respect it. So if you respect money, meaning that you don't squander it around, it will stay with you. If you don't respect it, it will fly away.
But that's not unique to the Islamic faith, certainly.
But that's a proof that we all come from the same origin, and we all came to reinforce our beliefs and our style of life to fit with that wonderful wheel cog of God. For instance, we look at money as a real thing only if it is related to a commodity. In other words, if you have paper money, pounds, dollars, yuan, whatever currency, these are just paper money printed by government authorities. But we have to convert it into a tangible commodity that can be rice, can be wheat, it can be gold, it can be silver, it can be something that is tangible. Do you know that if you bought it from me $100,000 in the year 1971, and I ask you to pay it back today, you have one of two choices. Either pay me $100,000 because we made an agreement that I'm not going to charge you interest on it or anything. But if you apply the Islamic law, you should have converted the $100,000 into gold or silver or rice or wheat, whatever commodity you agree to, because it has a tangible value. You can eat the wheat. You can eat the rice. You can use the gold as a pricing reference.
But what if one of those commodities is actually worth less than $100,000?
But that is the commodity of your choice. Usually the commodity that is prevalent in the society you live in. And if you were to pay me today, if I used gold as a reference, you know how much would you pay me? $4.25 million approximately.
Whoa.
Can you believe that?
So it's based on the price of the commodity at the time you pay the money back.
Exactly.
Okay. What does Islamic financial law teach about debt?
Debt is the worst thing in the sight of God. And the Prophet, as other prophets said, that if debt were a person, I would have taken care of him away from us, because debt is the worst burden. And that's the whole idea behind the training of the RIBIT, RIBA-free financial professionals. We teach them that your job is not to deepen the hole of debt for families. Your job is to get them out of that debt as soon as possible without overburdening them.
Would it be very surprising to find a family of the Islamic faith with a credit card?
All of us have credit cards.
Really? But you pay it off every month.
Exactly.
Okay.
The question is, do you use it to borrow and blow up your debt burden, or you pay it immediately and use it as a facility to facilitate your purchasing of
things. So you make sure that you are not paying any interest.
Exactly.
Got it. Dr. Yahya Abdul-Rahman, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor, and I hope to see you again.
And next week, Mormons, including a Romney family member, talk about their views on money and tithing. During the real estate boom, developers touted granite countertops and hardwood floors as must-haves for the modern homeowner. These days, they're trumpeting their green credentials: solar panels, triple-glazed windows, recycled building materials. Potential buyers are often told they could save money over the long run by buying a green home. But as Eve Tro reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, they'll almost certainly end up paying more than they would for the regular home next door.
Some people would say the community of Playa Vista can never be truly green. It's on the beach, just south of Los Angeles. Staunch environmentalists fought to save the wetlands here. They lost. Today, new houses, condos, and shops fill the space. Rich Rochelot works at nearby Loyola University. He remembers that debate.
You know, felt pretty strongly one way against development, but over time really have come to see what the developer has done with the area and that it is a very positive place.
In fact, he moved here to cut out his long commute. Rich and his dog, Scout, live in a brand new 3-bedroom, 2-bath condo. It has the highest green building rating. Under a system called Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED, it's platinum.
Do you tell people who visit that it's LEED platinum?
Yes, I do, proudly. Yeah. And nobody knows what that means.
Well, almost nobody.
But then I take the opportunity to explain it, you know, talk about the low energy bills, talk about the origin of the materials.
Rich's building, called Primera Terra, doesn't have some of the features you might associate with green. No solar panels, no rainwater collection barrels. Instead, it has super efficient insulation and lighting, a community garden, eco-friendly carpet and paint. The combination of cheaper power bills, non-toxic materials, and feeling like you're doing something for the planet, that's worth something. How much is hard to say, but green building advocates are trying. Niels Koch is a Dutch professor who followed 1.6 million home sales in California over 5 years.
What this study basically shows is if you make your home better or more efficient and it's labeled, on average, it leads to a higher price.
Up to 9%. The label part of that is important. Koch tracked the higher values only in houses with certified green credentials. He says it's hard to tease out why buyers paid more for those homes, but he did see something he calls the Prius effect.
So you got a street, lots of Prius vehicles. In that street, the premium paid for a green home is going to be higher as compared to a neighborhood where there's no hybrid.
Let's go back to Rich in Playa Vista. He didn't buy his $700,000 condo because of the green certification. It was more of a bonus after he fell in love with the place.
When I walked in, it was a beautiful sunny day, and I knew instantly that this was the place. The floor plan, the light.
Professor Koch says that makes sense. Location, view, or layout will always trump a home's green selling points. Green features are harder to put a value on because, for the most part, you can't see them. Plus, green is subjective. It changes neighborhood by neighborhood.
You know, backyard chicken coops are popular here. Might not be so popular in Beverly Hills.
That's Joanne Swiven, a real estate broker on the east side of the city, a suburban area called Eagle Rock. Most of the homes she sells are decades old. She says people in her neighborhood are into green, but few have a certified home.
If you see a house in our neighborhood with solar panels or some other obvious green upgrade, there is a very slim chance it's going to be LEED certified because they're older homes. They would have to rip them down, rebuild them from the ground up.
It's a lot harder to earn one of those labels with a retrofit than new construction. Swiven hypes features like passive solar. That's when the house was designed with the sun in mind.
In the winter, when the sun's lower, it hits your windows and heats your house. And in the summer, when the sun's higher, it's blocked by eaves and is shaded. It's something I look for. Most people don't know to look for. And if I see it, I'll point it out to buyers.
Do they care when you do tell them?
Sort of.
It does add to the impression that the house had a lot of thought put into it. Swiven says smart design increases price. And if green builders can align their efforts and their labels with that, they'll get a lot more popular. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is headed to Waterville, Maine, and the bedroom shelf of 10-year-old Anna Pittman. Anna's dad, Mark, has been trying to help her find that sweet spot between the pride of saving and the joy of spending.
My daughter, Anna, is 10. And probably ever since we started doing many things with her, she's been a saver.
Hi, my name is Anna, and I have been saving up since I was 7, pretty much. Well, I have some trouble saving it up sometimes, because sometimes I see something like, and I'm like, oh, I want to buy that. Then I think a while, and then I'm like, will I actually be happy with this? Will I actually use it and stuff?
So we went in to the store to get her iPod that she had saved up for over a year and a half for. We got it. We high-fived each other. She told people she'd been saving up for. It was an awesome celebratory experience. on the way out, as she has the iPod in her Apple bag, she looked at me and said, "Dad, you know, it's kind of dangerous being a saver like me in the sense that sometimes I save the money and then I don't want to ever spend it because I just like having the money there. But I would have missed out on the joy of getting something I'd worked for too. So there's got to be some sort of middle road between just saving and just spending. And I'm really glad I'm trying to hit that."
And I think you are. Nice work, Dad. And Anna, Piggy is on his way. Don't forget to feed him. I have no idea if he likes lobsters. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, we continue our series on religion and money.
Mormons or Latter-day Saints are often known for their practice of provident living. Having money set aside, having food set aside, having clothing and gasoline and whatever you might need for a rainy day.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.